back, let me tell you.
And we want to hear a little bit. You were gone for 2 months. We want to hear a little bit about your trip.
Okay, well, I was gone for 2 months. I spent 2 months in Indiana with my younger daughter, where I was really hoping to be in on the tomato harvest, but I was a little late. And the tomatoes were about gone by, but there was lots of basil, and there was plenty of peppers, and I got to get in on the potato harvest, so that was kind of fun. And the trip back was, I'm saying it's one of the best train trips I've ever had in my life, in spite of the fact that I had to spend a night in Chicago, because the train from Indianapolis, the Cardinal, only goes 3 days a week, and in order to check your bags, you can only leave on certain days. But the train to Portland from Chicago, the Empire Builder, was canceled. My train was canceled, so I had to spend a night in Chicago. And I know a lot of our listeners have heard the stories of the oil trains, and that is one of the issues going on with the Empire Builder, is the backup of the freight. But we're going to talk about the food that we bring on the train, because Chris also has some experience on the train.
Yeah, so tell me, it's tricky. If you go on the train and you eat on the train, it costs a lot of money.
And the food's not that great.
And it's not that great. So you kind of have to plan carefully, because there is, you're on the train for a while.
Food, 48 hours.
Right, 48
hours. From Chicago to Portland.
Food goes bad. So what kind of tips do you have?
Okay, so here's what I do when I go on the train. One of the great parts about the train is you can check two bags and you can carry on two bags. Plus, you can carry on your blankets and your pillows, in addition to your two bags. So I carry on a whole bag that is devoted to food needs. And I have an insulated cooler, and I freeze water before I get on the train. And I use that frozen water as my cooler. And so I take cheese and nuts and bread, and sometimes I have more food than I need. And matter of fact, this last trip, I did. So those are one of the good things is you can also take fruit. Fruit is a great way of carrying water. And what I do like to eat in the dining car once a day if I can. This last trip, the train lost power at lunchtime. I was going to go eat in the dining car for lunch, because that's a pretty decent time of day to have a good meal, and the train lost power, so they couldn't serve lunch.
So lunch was essentially canceled.
No, actually, it wasn't canceled, but about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when the train got back on, it's like you could go have lunch, but you knew that everybody else on the train was going to have lunch about that time too. So I decided I needed to be at my seat for other reasons that I won't get into on the food show, but I did not have lunch. But the greatest part about that train trip was that there was a filming crew on that train. And at first it was like, what is it with the cameras here? You know, it's like, I'm on the train. I was grubby, horrible me on the train. But it was Albert Maysles. And for those of you who don't know, Albert Maysles is a famous documentary filmmaker, best known for his films, Grey Gardens and Gimme Shelter. He and a crew were filming the train travel, the social dynamics of train travel, how much fun it is. And so they were a really good time, and I spent a couple of afternoons talking with Albert Maysles, you know, just sitting with him and chatting. So the last morning that I was on the train, I walked into the lounge car, and if any of you have taken the train, you know that when you get to Spokane, the train separates. Half of it goes to Seattle, and the other half comes to Portland. Well, the Portland part gets, Seattle gets the dining car, and Portland gets the lounge car. So, and at that point, there aren't that many people on the train. And it comes down the Columbia River. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the train trip. And I walked into the lounge car, and there was Albert sitting all by himself. And so I invited myself to sit down, and of course he's very open and welcoming, and I sat down with him, and I had in my bag the last of my train food. So I laid out a napkin on the middle of the table. I just did this. And on it I poured on the last of the almonds, the last of the cranberries, and a half a bar of chocolate, and invited him to join in. Well, you'd think the guy hadn't eaten in a month. It was awesome.
You made his day.
And, but especially the chocolate. He loved the chocolate. So that made my day, too. It was really fun. So it's always good to, you know, those were the final foods that I had left at that point. The almonds, the chocolate, and the cranberries.
It was sort of a celebration feast at the end of the trip.
It was. It was pretty cool. Yeah. So tell us a little about your train food.
Well, I ran into a situation where when you're planning for the train, you're kind of planning for a certain amount of hours. And it does take a while. So I was traveling from Portland in the opposite direction. I'm from Indiana, so I was heading back to Indiana. And I had a certain amount of food to get me there. And lo and behold, this is in the wintertime. And of course, I just assume that you can travel freely whenever you want. We the tracks get iced over and we get stuck behind. I mean, it was a number of events. There's some mudslides on the tracks. The tracks get iced over. We get stuck behind a whole bunch of freight trains. And so I run out of food before the end of the trip. So when I finally got off the train, it was that first meal. I was probably somewhere, you know, kind of boring, like a Panera Bread or something, but it was this amazing meal because the train
because
had gone longer.
So
I had run out of food. So I know next time that things can go wrong, bring more, have some reserves. So, but yeah, it's great to have you back, Kate. And we're excited to be doing the food show with you again.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting to be back.
Great. So let's get going here. We're going to get started with Peter.
Well, next up, I took an interview with a local chocolate maker, small business owner, Cara Blondie. She makes an interesting blend of chocolate and herbal spices, which bring a distinct sense of comfort that she seems to think come from a sort of a spiritual quest for harmony. And she'll kind of talk about that in the interview. I'm speaking now with Cara Blondie. You're the founder of Oma Chocolate. So how did you get into the chocolate making business? What pulled you into it? And what do you love about it?
Well, I got into it completely by accident. I was a senior in college and I didn't really want to admit it, but I was pretty depressed because I knew what I was majoring in. I didn't want to go out and have a career in it, which was teaching. And although I loved all the English and literature and poetry classes that I was taking, I also had a really bad case of writer's block. So a friend of mine encouraged me to take a break and do something that I loved. And in my mind, the only thing I loved was poetry and writing. And I was like, well, why? I can't. That's the only thing I love to do. And he said, well, what about chocolate? You're always eating it. You're always playing with blends. You're always saying, wouldn't it be great if they did this blend or tried this spice? And he said, I think, in fact, you should start a chocolate company. And he wrote me a check for $100. And I thought he was nuts.
That's your primary investor.
Yeah. So it was spring break. I cashed the check. I had no intentions of starting a business, and I did buy some more ingredients, so it was a great excuse to take a quarter off, and I never went back. So for the first couple of years, I did a lot of really goofy and wild things, like when I was making blends, I just would see if I could be happy when I was making them, independent of the type of spices that I was using. And why I love chocolate so much, it's kind of like poetry. It really speaks to the heart, and it's very, very receptive to moods. I think that's its power, is that it can speak to the heart, and it can flesh things out of your heart. So it's a great communicator, just the way poetry is.
One thing I love about cooking is how you can totally add your heart, like your emotions, your feelings as an ingredient. But it sounds like you took a sort of confusion, and you brought that into a place of deliciousness for food.
Totally. It was a state of confusion for maybe the first 5 years. I just worked a podunk coffee job, and I kept on, again, playing with blends and spices, tried all these raw cacao types, blends as well, individual varieties, as well as blending several types together. I think through all of that, while I love the bean to bar trend that's happening right now, and I think it's really important, I found my love was how everything comes together. And actually, that's where Olmo's name comes from. It's a Hindi word, and the word is koma, and it means to bring together or wholeness. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think that would be the perfect name, but then I looked at it again, and I was like, oh, if I just drop off the K, it's Olmo. Mm-hmm. And I was working on the happiness blend at the time, and so I like how your heart and chocolate can do that. They can bring things together.
So it's Koma without the K.
Koma without the K, yeah. But also, my grandma had died not too long right before I started the company. Had died within a couple of years. And she was German, and Oma is German for grandma. And I thought, oh, that's what grandmas do. They bring together.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. When I first started teaching myself how to temper the chocolate, I started out with the old-fashioned marble slab, and I learned to temper that way. And then I went to this way you can temper it where you're using a thermometer and you... but I still don't do as well that way as I do with the old-fashioned way.
You spoke to creating, the name Olmo when you were working on the happiness blend. Was the happiness blend the first chocolate that you made?
Yeah, and in fact, when I launched, I guess that's all I really wanted, because kind of part of what I faced when I was my senior year of college is I was going back for something that I really loved, which was English and poetry, and I thought I wanted to teach. And so when that didn't quite open up or unfold the way that I wanted it to, all I really cared about was just being happy and kind of like, well, where's my purpose? Where's my place in the world? And so just focusing on, can I be happy every day? That's a good place to start from. That just kind of became my primary focus, and kind of it was a fun challenge to see if I could, and that's how the spices actually slowly came to me.
The spices in there, those are the ones that help you relax, or they bring you happiness?
you're going to think
I'm just trying
crazy.
To wrap my brain around your construction process.
You can approach it from two different directions. If you approach it from more of the Western philosophy and a Western mind, for example, rose petal has some amazing qualities. It does calm the nervous system. Saffron and cardamom as well have amazing qualities of releasing extra endorphins, just like coffee. So it gives you that bliss feeling along with the cacao. There's a Eastern perspective. It's Ayurvedic blendings and medicine.
I didn't get that big word you used, Ayurvedic.
Ayurvedic, yeah. And it's a philosophy of you bring about balance by increasing something positive. And in the West, typically we approach healing or balance by...
excise the negative.
Yeah, exactly. Get rid of the negative. So anxiety, stress, depression, whatever you want, cancer, you cut it out or you get rid of it. For me, I liked the Eastern philosophy. It made a lot of sense because my particular nature is to bring joy, or that's more exciting to me, to bring something positive to the table or to focus where you want to go. And so I was like, oh, wow, could that be possible? That just happiness kind of became this, could it be as simple? I started thinking, could it be as simple as it's just like another muscle? Like a metaphorical muscle, but it's just like another muscle. What happens if you just practice that every day? What would that look like? What would that feel like? So I don't really know how much of it is specifically the spices. Like if you scientifically broke it down, I'm sure you could find all of that. But the other part of it I liked about is that it kind of, every time I eat it, I was like, oh yeah, this is what it's about. It kind of took me to that place in my heart where that's where the happiness is at.
Like when you were trying to come up with your ideas, did you have a bunch of different ideas and you're like, okay, this one's freedom and this one's happiness? Or
No, actually, I did the happiness and I launched it, and I had no other blends in mind. In fact, I had Olmo as a concept where it would be a lot of different food mediums besides chocolate. I got a lot of requests from merchants that they wanted more than one variety on the shelf. It makes it easier for the customer to want to try it. Or if they love it, they want to try more. And I just can't help myself like playing in the kitchen. So as I was playing with more blends, it's literally everyday stabs in the dark. You're like, oh, well, maybe I'll play with this. And so you add a spice into it, and then you melt it down. And my husband and I will sit and eat it at night, and what does this feel like? And then later, I kind of go back and do a little more of the, once I have something that I think is like, oh, wow, do more of the scientific research and behind it as far as the Ayurvedic blending, and does it fit, and is it balanced, and is there anything to be added or removed? So I kind of use my head at the very last part of the stage.
At that very last part, what's it like to taste that chocolate that you've made and say, okay, that's it, that's good enough to sell?
My test, real test, is that if I can eat it for literally months on end and I don't get sick of it, I don't grow bored of it. Mm-hmm. It's, to me, that's kind of like, okay, because I'm a super creative person, and part of my challenge in life has been to, I could create something really wonderful and then a year later just completely walk away with it. I created it and I'm done. Where, yeah, I thought, man, if I'm going to start a company, it's got to be dynamic enough to where I want to talk about it and do it over and over again for 30 years. That can be a little bit daunting for me.
Like, you got to either keep a business dynamic and like up with the times. You have to find out what flavors people are interested in.
And that was another thing. I didn't even know if people would be, these are kind of really off the wall concepts and untraditional blendings, I would say, at least for the Western palate.
Yeah, normal chocolate. Like, we'd expect like cookies and cream or white chocolate or like heavy cacao varieties. But I mean, actually, what sort of flavor? Maybe you could describe for people who haven't tried your chocolate. What, like, for instance, what's Freedom here?
Ah, so Freedom, if you look at the packaging, it's blue packaging. I think emotionally that blue color has that archetypal Freedom feel. But the base ingredients are lavender. And also use another herbal organic tea, but I won't tell you what that is.
Yeah, no, you shouldn't have to reveal your secrets.
But it has all the wonderful essence of lavender without having any of that soapy or often overly floral bouquet in the mouth that often people don't like about lavender in their food products. Mm-hmm. But the feeling is quite extraordinary. It's got a very Big Sky Montana feel. Mm-hmm. It's very expansive. It's got a little extra rock salt in it, and that helps ground your spirit so you don't completely fly away, if that makes sense.
Yeah. When looking at the packaging and hearing your metaphor, I was just imagining standing in a field and, yeah, like you're saying, rock salt's my root to the ground while my spirit expands in the lavender
exactly.
chocolate blend.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think that, for one, you should totally write that on the packaging. Just like, let your soul expand.
That's the trickiest part, is that when I was doing demos, all of these kind of very natural, intuitive ways to describe them came out. But darn it, you know, we were trying to design the packaging, I get that kind of white writer's block sometimes a little bit. And so the next packaging run, we're going to include some of those more descriptions that are, I think, a little closer to the experience you get when you meet the freedom or the happiness or the courage.
I think, well, I just love the flavors you're experimenting with. Like, pretty much we'll get fruit blends in the store, maybe, for chocolate types. Well, actually, I met you when you were doing a tasting. I wanted to ask you, one, what things you think chocolate goes great with. And the other thing was, we were having a cool chat before we started recording about like jazz and how that goes with chocolate.
Oh, well, I think chocolate is so powerful. It's so receptive to the heart, and I see it as a living thing. So there are certain things like poetry that you can read alone. You can be happy or sad with it, and it's this wonderful companion. And to me, that's the way chocolate works. And so poetry and chocolate are great, but also chocolate and jazz is great, because jazz hits this part of your heart that chocolate does too. And so we do these gatherings once a month at the Brasserie downtown, where we'll bring in a regional winemaker, pair it with Oma's blends. And it's so neat because they bring a different perspective of pairing the chocolate and the wine that maybe I wouldn't do. And then Cole Rubin Trio, this awesome, awesome kid. He's 19. And to Eric Beam and, gosh, I'm sorry, I'm blinking out on the third player.
Ben Turner.
So they'll come in and just play these great old classic jazz tunes, and it's kind of hits all the different components of your heart. It just really feel good evenings. It kind of happened by accident, but then when I was trying to think of the different ways that Chocolate can collaborate, the obvious one for me was doing poetry readings in Chocolate, but then someone suggested, you know, Chocolate and wine go really well together. You should see if there's any winemakers that want to collaborate. And so that's slowly, now we're actually doing other music besides jazz, but that one's really close to my heart.
When I went to a jazz tasting, like you just mentioned, and it sort of felt like indulging into a higher level of experience and sort of thoughtful taste. I mean, I really like raisinets and jazz, but combining all of these things is almost overwhelming.
Yeah, it's true. Jazz at its best is when it has all that intellectual nuances, but also it has that heart part that it's unpredictable. You don't know where it's going to go. It brings us that joy or that excitement. And Chocolate can do the same thing as well.
Do you have any recipes that you've discovered in the chocolate making process, or I mean, maybe as you've been exposed to pairings with interesting foods?
Something's coming around, and the base spice is chamomile.
Chamomile.
I was completely, really? Chamomile? Because I've been kind of working almost with more of your chai-like spices, like coriander, turmeric, chocolate, of course, a little bit of cinnamon, but it was almost a little bit too fiery or explosive. So now I've got this interesting chamomile blend. I'm still not quite sure if it's there, but boy, it's fun. It's fun to play with. And you can, you know, for anyone at home, kind of a fun thing to do is buy an unsweetened cacao powder and just go home and start playing with adding spices to it. It's sometimes you throw them out, but other times you can get really delighted and surprised.
All right. Well, thanks, Kara. You've been great.
And thanks so much for having me on the show.
That was Kara Blondie with Oma Chocolate. You can find her on the web or try her chocolate at one of those same jazz tastings at the Brasserie. So next we're going to have a song by Jonathan Rickman and the Modern Lovers. It's time for Double Chocolate Malted.
Double chocolate malted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, ma'am, a single's not enough. Not enough, no.
No, no, no.
I want a double chocolate malted today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want that Horlicks brand of chocolate malt. You know, I like
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I want two scoops.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't want just a single. No whipped cream either.
No, no, no.
No marshmallow.
chocolate malted today. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, double chocolate malted today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Me and Mikey.
Welcome back to the food show. That was Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. And so we're going to go into a story from Sandra Katz. You may remember in the last episode of The Food Show last month, we had an interview with Sandra Katz. And in this interview, he talks about a trip that he takes to Indonesia where he learns about a traditional process of making tempeh. And I find it kind of really interesting and really pertinent when we have these conversations about food safety and modernization, the kind of difference between sort of an industrial lab version of making food and then these sort of traditional home ways of making food. So he kind of gives us that example with tempeh. So here is Sandra Katz.
So tempeh is a style of fermenting soybeans where you basically use molds that digest the soybeans and also bind them together into a mat that's typically sliced up and fried, and it comes from the Indonesian island of Java.
Hello?
Tempeh
check,
has
check,
been
check,
available
check,
in
check,
the
check,
United
check.
States since the 70s. And, it's really easy to trace exactly how tempeh became popular in the U.S. and it was
through
subcultures, and specifically from a community in Tennessee called The Farm, which was sort of trying to have a basically soy-based vegan diet, but they recognized that they couldn't just eat soybeans even though they were so protein rich, so they started investigating different traditional ways of preparing soybeans, and they learned about tempeh from food scientists at Cornell, as I understand it. And they obtained a sample of a starter for tempeh that was a pure culture starter of a mold called Rhizopus oligosporus that actually... the USDA maintains a culture collection, and they basically obtained a sample of the strain of Rhizopus oligosporus that's in the USDA's culture collection, and it's called Var Saito. And Saito is a Japanese microbiologist who, I guess, is the first microbiologist who really investigated tempeh, and out of the tempeh sort of picked that particular strain out as the sort of active principle of the tempeh. And in microbiology, this has really been, the approach to fermentation is sort of, look at these, undefined, groups of organisms that are found on different traditional foods and really pick out the essential organisms, out of that to get rid of everything that's extraneous. Because the bias in microbiology is that, in general, microorganisms are, dangerous. And, we should just figure out what the specifically functional ones are and get rid of all the other ones. So, in a laboratory under sterile conditions, it's pretty easy to propagate a pure strain fungus. But in a home kitchen, it's extremely challenging, and I would say it's the most challenging thing that I've ever done in the realm of fermentation is trying to propagate pure culture Rhizopus oligosporus. And I've done it a few times, but with limited success. But I was amazed when I went to Indonesia and visited a village where they produce tempeh, to see what the source of the culture was. And it basically, this guy pulled down a shoebox filled with these moldy leaves of a particular tree. They call it the waru tree. It's a hibiscus family tree. And basically each time they make tempeh, they take a few of the beans out and place maybe a half dozen beans between two leaves of this tree that's right outside their compound, and then over-ripen it. So when they peel the leaves apart, it's a whole mycelial mat, but it's also it's also sort of turned a dark color, the color of sporulation of that particular mold. Or though it's actually a couple of colors. There's like tan ones that are indicative of aspergillus molds, along with black ones that are indicative of rhizopus molds. So they're working with a mixed community that evidently has the ability to perpetuate itself pretty easily. So you know, basically the way that they made tempeh is, you know, they had dehulled the beans and split them and cooked them and then laid them out on this big table to dry. And their batch was basically a 50 kilo bag of soybeans. So it's like 100 pounds of dry soybeans that they had, you know, dehulled and split and cooked, and they were drying it and cooling it. And once you get rid of most of the surface moisture and you get it down to body temperature, then it's time to introduce the culture. And the way they did that is this guy took one leaf in each of his hands and then just sort of, you know, dug into the soybeans, lifted up a handful, and moved his hands against each other, basically to rub these leaves against the surfaces of lots of beans. And then he'd just like pick up another handful and rub them and just try to get different portions of this big pile of soybeans. You know, and then at the end, once he felt they were adequately cultured, before putting it all in, you know, the bags that serve as the forms for the blocks of tempeh, he perpetuated it by taking a few of the beans and putting it between some leaves and doing maybe a half a dozen set of leaves like that to perpetuate it. But I just loved the simplicity of how, you know, in their little, you know, sort of low-tech village operation, they were able to perpetuate it, in contrast to, you know, the extraordinary sterilization methods that are required for perpetuating sort of the single strain that we're mostly working with in the U.S. And to me, it was just, you know, a story of how, you know, sort of the science of microbiology, you know, with its biases against these broad, undefined communities of organisms, which are really what all traditional fermentations are based on. You know, in an effort to improve on the cultures, you know, they've actually, you know, disempowered people and made it something that it's impossible for, you know, the casual generalist to propagate.
That's Sander Katz, and you're listening to The Food Show. To hear the interview that goes along with that story, you can listen back to last month's episode of This Food Show on the KBOO website, or you can go and find it at the Underground Airwaves. That's the project that it is, the podcast that it is airing on at the Edible Portland website.
And Jen Davis is in the studio to talk about the bees and the butterflies. Thanks for joining us, Jen.
Thank you for having me.
And first, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be our go-to person for information about bees and butterflies?
Well, I have a long experience with bees. I've been raising native mason bees for about 12, 13 years now. And I've taught classes around the Northwest for the Soil and Water Conservation Service and Portland Fruit Tree Project, Sunnyside School, and other places about how to raise the bees and what we can do to help to conserve the bees.
What sparked your interest?
First came gardening. I started studying windowberry and permaculture about 25 years ago, and I grow 16 kinds of fruit in my yard and many of my vegetables. And when you grow so much fruit, you really become aware of the need for pollinators. And mason bees are known as orchard bees because they're just fantastic fruit pollinators. And so I get a huge bounty of fruit every year because I've got all my little friends, the mason bees.
And you have a big update for us. What's going on with the bees?
Sure. There's quite a few things that are of note about the bees happening. The USDA has reported that over this past winter, the bee loss, the managed honeybee loss, which is what they track, looks to be about 31%, which is about what has been over the past 5 to 8 years, which is pretty significant. The winter bee loss for 2013 here in Portland was 42%, which is quite high, and that's something that my organization, Bee Friendly Portland, has been working to address. And Europe, interestingly enough, is actually saying that there is such a bee crisis over there that they expect serious food shortages from lack of pollinators within about 5 years if this concern is not addressed. What's happening is biofuels have been written into the law over there in many countries in Europe as a way of getting alternative, what some consider eco-fuels, into use. But unfortunately, these crops that they're using for the biofuels are canola, sunflower, and soy, and all of these depend on bees for pollination. And Europe, just like the rest of the world, has seen some serious bee declines over the past 10, 15 years in particular, some from pesticides and pests, but also climate change is affecting them and lack of forage. And so as their bees decline, these biofuels are causing an increased demand for what is disappearing, the bees. And they're seeing that wild bees may be their only hope for being able to actually pollinate their crops.
Are the wild bees doing better?
Well, wild bees in Europe, just like here in the United States, have seen a decline. Over the past century on the North American continent, we've seen 50% of our wild bee species disappear. However, there are still wild bees. Fortunately, some of them are healthier than others, and there's an increased interest in ways to help to promote them by creating habitat, forage, reducing pesticide usage. And Europe actually banned for 5 years the neonicotinoid pesticide recently, which is fantastic because there are very dramatic scientific researches that have found that these pesticides are particularly difficult for bees to deal with because they affect their ability to learn, to navigate, and their immunity. And the neonicotinoids have been linked with colony collapse disorder, along with other pesticides, actually. But unfortunately, Bayer Company, which creates neonicotinoids, and Syngenta, both of them are suing the EU to try to stop that ban.
So I'm wondering, since, you know, it is a problem all over the world with the neonicotinoids, now that Europe is sort of a control, are we seeing their numbers improving or maybe declining less than in the United States?
Well, I think it's too early to tell. It's a fairly recent ban, and you know, they've had to fight it every step of the way. Also, Europe, although they wisely have banned the planting of some GM crops, they are following a lot of the models of agriculture that we're doing here in the States, and they do use a lot of conventional pesticides. So it remains to be seen. Further, Europe has the added problem of having less land for the population. And so whenever you're turning more and more of it to agriculture to produce biofuels in addition to food, you're losing a lot of vital bee habitat that would sustain not a monocrop for one season, but a variety of forage throughout the seasons.
You mentioned that you keep mason bees. Do they have the same issues?
Well, mason bees are affected by some of the same pests and diseases as honeybees and some not. For example, the varroa mite does not affect the mason bee, but there is a different kind of mite that is affecting our mason bees. They both suffer from diseases like chalk brood, which is a fungal disease. So there are, when those who raise mason bees, entomologists are increasingly encouraging them to be more informed. You know, the old model was you'd go out and you get a wooden block and drill holes in it and just think that you were raising mason bees. But unfortunately, we're finding that over time, predatory mites and diseases will build up within these blocks and just kill all of your stock. So you really need to take a more proactive approach and become educated about how to properly raise mason bees. And I teach classes on that.
I was just going to say, so you can't use the old ordinary block of wood anymore, huh?
Entomologists are really suggesting not, and those who have experimented with the blocks will often find that after a few years, they say, where did my mason bees go? Well, it's because the mason bee is unusual. It actually will create its own cocoon in which to pupate over winter, much like a butterfly would. And these cocoons actually can be taken out of the out of a paper straw, if you're growing them in paper straws, which is what I do, and they can be segregated between diseased ones and those that are predated by predatory wasps and so on. And then you can make sure that you're not replicating the same diseases and pests in your yard again and again and again to affect your stock. So,
You mentioned butterflies. You have some things to tell us about butterflies,
yes,
too.
Well, it was particularly tragic this year in the central mountains of Mexico, where, you know, every year thousands, millions of butterflies have been migrating over 2,000 miles to overwinter in the forests of central Mexico. This year, their return was extremely delayed, and when they did arrive, it was dramatic decrease. The fewest amount ever seen in 20 years. Normally, they spread out over about 10 acres, and this year it was about an acre, and people are shocked at the loss of the butterflies. And when they're looking at the patterns of the butterfly migrations, increasingly their route to this area is flying over what has now been turned into about 80 million acres of GM soy crops. And these GM soy crops are genetically engineered to withstand heavy, heavy application of glyphosate, the Roundup. And the Roundup, because you're spraying so much of it in the area, you're destroying all of the other forage, which would be important for the monarchs. And monarchs are an insect which is dependent upon the milkweed flower. And if they cannot find milkweed to eat and actually to lay its eggs on, they lay their eggs on the milkweed plant, then they cannot continue to reproduce. And so it's the loss of forage due to the glyphosate and possibly, most likely, some sort of toxification from feeding on the nectar of these GM plants, which, you know, are inbred with pesticides right into their genes. So it's a pretty bad mix. And in addition, climate change, droughts, and cold winters are affecting both the bee and butterfly populations.
Now, you mentioned that it's the lowest count in 20 years. This has happened before?
Well, that is when they've been taking good count of what's been going on. So you saw huge numbers 20 years ago, and it's just been steadily decreasing, and it's now at an all-time low.
And we've been hearing about trying to save our milkweed plants for well over 20 years.
That's right. And in fact, there's a huge need for people to grow milkweed plants. And if that's something that there's a kind of monarch that is native to Oregon, not all monarchs will feed on all milkweed. It's kind of, they're very complex.
Eaters,
that's
they?
Right. They're complex. And so there's a milkweed that grows here in the Northwest that the monarchs like. And so you can learn about that by going to the Monarch Project online.
The monarchproject.org?
Yes, and they'll tell you about what kind of milkweed you could grow to help support the butterflies, the monarchs.
Oh, would growing milkweed in your yard, say, would that attract more monarchs?
Well, I mean, ideally it would, although actually we're seeing fewer and fewer of them. I mean, I've been gardening for, you know, half my life, and usually I see at least a few monarchs a year, and I didn't see any last year. So they're definitely declining, and anything that we can do to help them is a good step forward.
And what is their role as butterflies, as pollinators? What do they do in the food system?
Right. Well, the monarchs lay their eggs on the milkweed plant, and actually what they found is the reason is because there's a latex in the milkweed plant that they eat that is poisonous, not to them, but to a lot of other things, and it makes them taste very yucky to birds. And that's why they like the milkweed plant. You know, it's a survival evolutionary strategy. They will pollinate other flowers, though, which means that they feed on the nectar of diverse number of flowers. So again, growing flowers in your yard, especially native flowers, wildflowers, are some of the best things that you can do to help bees and butterflies.
And milkweed shoots are also delicious to eat.
There you go. I've never eaten them.
For our listeners here in the Willamette Valley, what are some local flowers that we might consider?
Right. There's lots and lots of flowers. Personally, what I like to grow in my yard, there are some native violets, which are fantastic. There's things like the winter berries. I particularly like things like the myosotis or the forget-me-nots, which are not native, but they're not invasive, and they're a fantastic crop because they will self-sow over the years, and they bloom just exactly when the bees come out. There's lots of plants like asters, different kinds of the Oregon grape is just a fantastic bee plant for the mason bees in particular because it blooms very early. So when you are raising mason bees, that's something that you need to think about if you want to raise them, is you have to grow crops that will, flowers that will bloom when they emerge, because unlike honeybees, which have a long season, you know, because they're constantly replenishing their colony, mason bees have a very short life cycle, and they'll emerge as adults. They'll be around for about 2 months, and then they die. So you have to have plants that are blooming right whenever they emerge, which would be about between, ideally between February, March, April. You want to be really focusing on growing plants for them. Some of your mason bees will stick out until around May, but you're not going to see many at all after the end of May.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you've made a note here, robotic bees.
Yes.
Tell us about
well,
the
robotic
bees. Well,
that's going to save us all, is robotic bees.
Oh, my goodness.
Right now, the Harvard RoboBee Project, which is funded by the National Science Foundation, they believe that they're going to save us all with their pollination when our bees are gone. They will autonomously pollinate field crops, perform search and rescue tasks, hazardous environment exploration, military surveillance, and so much more.
Many drones? Yes.
Many drones, if you will. So, you know, maybe we don't need bees.
Oh,
you know, you make that judgment.
Oh my goodness! Oh, I was going to ask you about the other item. Oh, dear! Now I'm totally like, wow, well, mini drones.
That's a bad joke too. We're talking about bees, mini drones.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. It is a
bad
joke.
Drones, exactly.
Right. It's a bad joke, and you wanted to talk a little bit about the economy of
right.
Pollination.
Should be aware that, of course, as food shortages can happen with the declining bee population, of course, our food costs are going to go dramatically up. And there's
if
a lot.
If we even have food.
That's right. And there's also a huge economic issue here. Research has shown that 1 in 12 jobs in the United States are linked to bees. We depend on food. Food is a major force in our economic model here in this country. An example is 4 out of 5 apples that are eaten in this country come from Washington State. Well, right now, the FDA is considering approving the Arctic apple, which, if introduced, could be possibly quite dangerous for bees. What it does is it contains an antibiotic, which is bred into every single cell of the plant, including the roots and the bark and so on of the apple tree. And the reason they're putting it in it is so that the apple won't brown when you cut it open. And
that's crazy.
Yes. Well, it's being considered, and it could likely be approved.
And so this is a GMO apple?
It's a GMO apple, right. And so apples are completely
apple.
Dependent upon bees for cross-pollination. So if you consider, if you're bringing a GM apple like that and introducing that into Washington State, then those GM genes will then be spread to other apple varieties, and pretty soon we could have our apples all containing an antibiotic. And no tests have been done that I have been able to find on its safety for bees. including humans or humans for that matter. So that's an example. Also, Enlist corn is coming out. That's just been approved by the FDA. It's called Enlist corn. It is specially bred to be resistant to the weed killer known as 2,4-D. And 2,4-D was one of the ingredients in Agent Orange. And it has been associated with Parkinson's disease, metabolic disorder, and brain function disorder, among other things. And it's been really discouraged from use for agriculture and for about 25 years because of all of the toxicity related with this herbicide. But unfortunately, the Roundup Ready crops are so much failing. There's so these super weeds that are coming in now that have become resistant to the Roundup that they're now having to use 2,4-D. And so you are going to be eating foods pretty soon which are which have been sprayed with this material, which was part of Agent Orange, and of course, so will our bees be feeding on this nectar
if they can survive it.
Yes.
What can we do as consumers?
Well, there's a lot that you can do right now. Monsanto is trying to push stopping the labeling on a federal level of GMOs. So you can go to fooddemocracynow.org and read about how you can sign petitions on that. Also,
signing petitions is, you know,
right. Well, locally, there's things that you can do. For example, neonicotinoids. Portland Nursery in the fall. Mm-hmm. Time is rolling by. They got rid of all the neonicotinoids on their shelves after consumer pressure, but they are considering putting them back, according to an article that I read. I don't know if that's true, but it's certainly worth calling them up and saying, please do not put those neonics back on the shelves. And anytime you go to a nursery, ask them, are you carrying neonicotinoids? Bayer Advanced products all contain neonics. And you can go to the Xerces Society, Xerces Society website, and there's a full list of all the neonicotinoid pesticides. And if we could at least drive these out of Portland, that would be a really powerful thing that we could do for our local bees.
Do I recall that some plants, when you buy them from the nurseries, already have the neonicotinoids?
Yeah, Home Depot and Lowe's, the Friends of the Earth, did a survey and found that 52% of all the plants bought at Home Depot and Lowe's, and also just basically plants from larger nurseries could contain neonicotinoids already bred into them. They'll be in their soil mixture, or actually the seeds have been treated that they've been grown from. So once you plant a plant that has been treated with neonics in your yard, it essentially is a poisonous plant to bees. And it expresses those neonicotinoid pesticides year-round and in the pollen and the nectar, and that's why they're particularly dangerous to bees.
Are there things that we should not do?
I would encourage people, especially with the introduction of 2,4-D, to avoid genetically modified crops as much as possible. I know that organic food can be more expensive. It's certainly not always more expensive, but 80% of conventional foods now contain some genetically modified ingredients. And that's bad for your health. There's a lot of studies that are showing relationship to all kinds of cancers and brain function disorder, metabolic disorders that are related with the organophosphates that are applied to them. And, there's other studies that are still showing that GM crops could be bad for us. There's not, there's a variety of studies out there, but we need to stop the industry by stop eating the food.
Was there something else we need to talk about with the other pollinators, maybe? Are there other?
There's absolutely a lot of other wild pollinators out there besides mason bees that we can take care of. So this spring, when you're thinking about what you can do for bees, you can look into planting a lot of flowers in your yard, leaving a wild area in your yard that is not disturbed. Make it a sunny area. It doesn't have to be very big, even if it's only 2 by 2. A lot of our native pollinators are actually ground dwellers. People are not aware of that. And if you are leaving some ground that's friable and sunny and not disturbed with some flowers around it, then
or
it's
with
possible.
Poisons.
Right. Then it's possible that you're going to get some nice ground dwelling pollinators to live there. Put out a little shallow dishes of water with pebbles in them on a regular basis because they do get thirsty. Don't use poisons. Tell your neighbors not to use poisons. And just encourage your neighbors to do the same thing. You know, if we all made these basic steps of trying to eat more organic, more local, and gardening and leaving habitat for the bees, we could go a long way just here in Portland to really help to sustain and stabilize our bee populations.
No, thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
Great. So we're coming to the end of this episode of Food Show. I'd like to thank our guests, Kara Blondi, Sander Katz, and Jen Davis. You can hear an archive of this show on the KABU website. Also, you can stay connected with The Food Show on Facebook. The Food Show airs every third Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m. here on KABU. Make sure to stay tuned in to KABU for some jazz.
See you all next month.
Belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make when their families could be growing food, working those lands for corporations. Don't do hungry people no good, cause people need food in their belly, need some drink for the dry in their throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly, need some drink the dry in their throat, a need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same hole. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil and those burgers.
This is KABU Headline News at Noon for January 15, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, after inmate lawyers failed to reach an agreement with Governor Jerry Brown addressing the prison crowding problem in California, it was announced that federal judges will order a solution. Brown and inmate lawyers have now been given until January 23 proposed terms for an agreement that will go into effect April 18. However, the governor planned his fiscal year 2014-2015 budget proposal on the assumption that the court would grant California additional 2 years to comply with the order. The judges said they will decide within 30 days whether to grant the state a 2-year extension to reduce the prison population.
Washington state lawmakers are considering introducing legislation that medical marijuana users fear will seriously damage their rights. A bill has been introduced to integrate the medical and recreational markets. Users see the proposed bill as going too far, forcing patients to register on the state database, removing collective gardens, redefining chronic pain, and reducing possession amounts from 24 to 3 ounces. Ultimately, these limits could force the system's more than 100,000 patients into the heavily taxed, more expensive recreational system that potentially will deliver a far less effective product. However, if the state fails to act, the U.S. Department of Justice may crack down on dispensaries.
In national news, the federal government has begun releasing demographic data on who is signing up.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for January 15, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, after inmate lawyers failed to reach an agreement with Governor Jerry Brown addressing the prison crowding problem in California, it was announced that federal judges will order a solution. Brown and inmate lawyers have now been given until January 23 proposed terms for an agreement that will go into effect April 18. However, the governor planned his fiscal year 2014-2015 budget proposal on the assumption that the court would grant California additional 2 years to comply with the order. The judges said they will decide within 30 days whether to grant the state a 2-year extension to reduce the prison population.
Washington state lawmakers are considering introducing legislation that medical marijuana users fear will seriously damage their rights. A bill has been introduced to integrate the medical and recreational markets. Users see the proposed bill as going too far, forcing patients to register on the state database, removing collective gardens, redefining chronic pain, and reducing possession amounts from 24 to 3 ounces. Ultimately, these limits could force the system's more than 100,000 patients into the heavily taxed, more expensive recreational system that potentially will deliver a far less effective product. However, if the state fails to act, the U.S. Department of Justice may crack down on dispensaries.
In national news, the federal government has begun releasing demographic data on who is signing up for Obamacare. 24% of signups on either state or federal exchanges are young people between 18 and 24, well below the government target of 40%. Unless government targets are met, premiums for other policyholders could have to be raised. However, the law allows insurers to charge up to 3 times as much for older people, which would significantly soften the impact. It has always been assumed the most healthy would sign up last, so the numbers could eventually balance.
A number of prominent economists, including 8 former presidents of the American Economic Association, signed a letter to the President and Congress Tuesday endorsing the economic benefits of raising the minimum wage to $10.10 per hour. They said the legislation would directly benefit 17 million workers by 2016, and another 11 million workers whose wages are just above the new minimum would likely see a wage increase as employers adjust their compensation systems. In addition, it would lift 1.6 million people out of poverty. Minimum wage workers who work full-time for a full year would see a raise from $15,000 to roughly $21,000.
In international news, Mexican military and vigilante groups clashed early Tuesday as soldiers attempted to disarm citizens fighting a local crime cartel. The troops were sent to retake Tierra Caliente after several days of violence between self-defense groups and the Knights Templar cartel. The initial conflict began early Tuesday when soldiers tried to take arms away from vigilantes staffing a roadblock where locals refused to allow the soldiers to pass. The vigilantes, who were asked to lay down their arms and allow the government to handle the cartel, say they are fearful of being killed by the cartel and that federal forces are ineffectual because they have been infiltrated by the cartel along with other criminal elements.
German Chancellor Merkel denied that talks regarding U.S. spying were near collapse. She says the German government continues to push for a solution to this sensitive issue. Reports from inside Germany maintain that U.S. officials refuse to promise that Washington will refrain from eavesdropping on German ministers and other top government officials. A government source in Berlin told Reuters that the United States remains interested in a deal, but is reluctant to give a blanket pledge not to monitor government members. This is Diane Erickson
and Patrick Wilson
with the KBOO News at Noon, produced by volunteers in our Southeast studio in Portland, Oregon. Tune in every night at 5 o'clock for more local, national.